Hello, and welcome to the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Yan, and today I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Mary Barden, part of our neuro-oncology department here at the Yale University School of Medicine. Mary is a Yale lifer who attended Yale University School of Medicine for her medical degree and stayed here for both her internal medicine internship and subsequent neurology residency. After graduation, she stayed here for her neuro-oncology fellowship, and now she is a much-loved member of our department. Thank you for joining me today, Mary. And how are you doing?
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin. It's very flattering. You guys are great to work with. And I'm doing well. I'm excited to be here. Yeah.
So Mary has agreed to come on and talk about neurologic complications of systemic treatments of cancer today, which is a big topic, but one that I think all of us as neurology residents or neurologists will have exposure to at some point in our residency or our careers. So it's an important topic that I thought we'd cover today.
First, I'll say I definitely agree that this is becoming an increasingly important topic for neurology residents in training to be aware of and to know at least some of the basic things about. We've come so far in cancer, and there's treatments and options available now. Patients are living longer than ever before, and with that, developing new neurologic complications from both the cancer and the treatments from it that we haven't seen. And so on any inpatient consult service or in the ER seeing patients, these are types of diagnoses that need to be on your differential.
And I'll also add that a lot of these complications do certainly show up on certification examinations, including the upcoming RITE.
Yes, also that. So the neurologic complications of cancer. Generally, when I'm giving this lecture, I break it down into really three main categories. There's the direct complications of the cancer, and really that is going to be metastases. That's the cancer elsewhere in the body, either metastasizing to the brain, to the spinal cord, or elsewhere that exerts some sort of effect on the neurologic system and cause neurologic symptoms, either focal related to where the tumor is, can cause things like seizures. One important category under direct complications or metastases is the category of leptomeningeal metastases, and that is when the cancer finds its way to the spinal fluid space itself. It is something that is previously a very rare complication, but we're seeing it more and more now as patients are living longer. There's better therapies that are keeping patients in disease remission systemically for a longer period of time. And so we're seeing this dissemination into the CSF with increasing frequency, I would say, in my experience. And really, any type of cancer is capable of doing it. We have this frame in our mind of these cancers are more likely to go to the brain or to go to the leptomeninges as compared to others. But I find more and more that really anything has that potential. So it's an important diagnosis to keep in mind when you're seeing patients with cancer with new neurologic symptoms. That's really the direct complications.
And for more information about primary neurologic malignancies as well as metastatic malignancies, we do have an episode recorded by neuro-oncologist Dr. Nicholas Blodden from approximately 2 years ago that I would encourage our listeners to go back and review, as it's a good topic to be familiar with for the upcoming RITE. Next, we have the indirect neurologic complications.
Indirect is not the cancer itself necessarily going to the brain and causing symptoms, but rather the body's response to the cancer, an indirect immune-mediated response to the cancer that's causing neurologic symptoms. Essentially what that is paraneoplastic syndromes. And I understand you guys had a podcast about that.
Yeah, back in 2021, episode 38, the paraneoplastic and autoimmune disorders episode.
Yeah, so I won't get too much into that. There's a lot of overlap with us and with neuroimmunology in dealing with these cases. And so you'll find both specialties getting involved. So we talked about the direct cancer itself going to the nervous system or exerting effects on it. The indirect, basically our body's response to the cancer indirectly creating neurologic symptoms. And then the third major category, and I think the one we'll spend the most time talking about today, are the treatment-related complications. So not the cancer itself causing neurologic symptoms either directly or indirectly, but the things that we do as physicians, oncologists to treat the cancer. That's going to include the more classical treatments, things like chemotherapy and radiation and the spectrum of neurologic side effects that come with that. And then even more importantly, what we're seeing now with increasing frequency are the neurologic syndromes related to new immune therapies used to treat cancer. Your immune checkpoint inhibitors, CAR T-cell therapy, they all have these neurologic syndromes associated with them that we need to monitor and watch out for.
And as a quick plug for our listeners, a great reference that I would refer everyone to is the Neurology Continuum issue that just came out in December 2023, as we're recording this not even 1 month after it came out. It has a really good summary of a lot of these complications that we're sure to see in both clinical practice and on certification examinations. So how do you think about chemotherapy-related neurotoxicities, Mary?
So chemotherapy-related. I suppose the best way to think about this is to break it down into the peripheral nervous system injury and then the central nervous system injury, an injury being from the neurotoxicity of the chemotherapy itself. I will say probably the peripheral nervous system effects are what I see more commonly in practice, specifically neuropathy, usually a sensory neuropathy. And there's a number of agents that are commonly implicated in that. The platinum-containing compounds, oxaliplatin is a big one that's used to treat colon cancer, among others. Oxaliplatin is pretty well described in causing length-dependent neuropathy in these patients, and it's a dose-dependent fashion. The more cycles of treatment they get, these symptoms can worsen, and the severity of neuropathy can often be a limitation to how many doses of this medication patients can tolerate. So it's something that we look out for carefully. I will also say, particularly with platinum-containing compounds, we can also see this phenomenon called coasting, where even if you stop the offending agent, like the oxaliplatin, the neuropathy can continue to get worse for a period of time after that, before it starts to stabilize and may or may not get better with time. But yes, platinum-containing compounds is going to be a major offender in terms of causing neuropathy in cancer patients. The vinca alkaloids, vincristine, being a big one that we use in neuro-oncology to treat primary CNS lymphoma, is also one that is implicated in neuropathy, usually a small fiber neuropathy, but we monitor patients to make sure that they're not developing motor difficulties. We usually ask, you know, are you having trouble buttoning buttons, open jars over the course of their chemotherapy treatment? And if they start having those issues, often we end up removing vincristine from the treatment plan because these side effects, the neuropathy that's causes, may not be necessarily reversible. And so if we start to see more severe symptoms affecting motor function, we'll often stop it. Taxanes are another big one that cause neuropathy. You'll often see that in breast and gynecologic cancers. There's some other ones used in more of the hematologic malignancies, but for the purposes of what you would experience on service in the hospital and then also for your certification exams, the big ones to think about are platinum, the vinca alkaloids, and the taxanes as neuropathy-inducing agents. So that's the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system is a bit of a rarer thing, I would say, at least in my experience, but can certainly be seen. Some of the neurologic syndromes we see that's more centrally mediated, we have patients that can develop acute encephalopathy with certain chemotherapies. Aseptic meningitis, PRESS is a big one, posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome. You see that with a lot of different agents. Chemotherapy is also one of them. One that we can see, particularly with our primary CNS lymphoma patients again, is a cerebellar toxicity, an acute one. We see that with high doses of cytarabine, which we use for consolidation treatment in our lymphoma patients. Patients develop a rather acute cerebellar syndrome with ataxia, nystagmus, and the like. And it may not be fully reversible, so that's something that we have to counsel our patients on before we treat them with that medication. Another one we see is leukoencephalopathy, and this is one we particularly look out for in patients that are receiving high-dose methotrexate, which our primary CNS lymphoma patients also fall under that category, essentially progressive white matter disease related to cumulative doses of methotrexate, either administered IV or intrathecally can also increase that risk.
And for our listeners, what's the common imaging finding that you'll see when someone has methotrexate toxicity?
So it can depend. So there's a form of it that looks very much like a stroke with diffusion restriction, ADC correlate, perhaps a flare associated, but not always. And it can look exactly like a stroke, but it tends to go away on its own. It's not something that requires thrombolytics or revascularization or anything like that. It's really just related to the drug itself. That we tend to see with intrathecal methotrexate in the pediatric population. It can happen in adults as well. But you also see the more cumulative effects of just receiving multiple doses or many doses of high-dose methotrexate over time, just causing a progressive white matter disease phenomenon without necessarily having that acute presentation that looks like a stroke. And I remember a case from when I was in residency. You're on call for pediatric ER, mm-hmm. and you have a case coming in as a stroke code, and you hear cancer history in any way, you have to immediately go to, is this hematologic? Mm-hmm. Are they getting methotrexate? Because that's going to be your most common scenario, especially in that population. And sure enough, that's what it was. And you give high folinic acid rescue, and that's part of the way of managing it. Mm-hmm. So yes, leukoencephalopathy. Neurovascular side effects is another big one that we think about. In particular, an agent that comes to mind is bevacizumab, or Avastin is another name for it. It's not actually a chemotherapy. It's a monoclonal antibody against vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. And it can cause a number of vascular or cardiovascular related side effects, but one of the ones to be aware of as neurologists is it can increase the risk of ischemic stroke. And so that's something to be aware of when you have patients coming in who are on Avastin and then have stroke-like symptoms, to think about that as a causative agent. The last one I would think of within that central nervous system injury category is this idea of a chemo brain. You'll hear a lot of patients say that exactly. They're chemo brain. They're not as sharp as they used to be before starting all these rounds in chemotherapy. And it's not necessarily associated with one particular agent or one drug more so than the other. It just seems to be this collective exposure to these toxic medications that people just develop this cognitive impairment over time. And there's people that do some dedicated research on this topic, have a little bit more of a nuanced understanding of it than I do. But just something to be aware of, that patients who have a long history of cancer and have had many rounds or different lines of therapy over the years will often tell you that their memory is not what it used to be, more forgetful, those types of things.
Once again, for our listeners, I'll remind you that a lot of this information comes from the most recent Neurology Continuum on Neuro-Oncology, so it's a fantastic resource I encourage everyone to go read. After chemotherapy, another mainstay of oncologic treatment is radiation. So what are the kinds of things that we think about for radiation-induced neurotoxicity?
So radiation-related neurotoxicity, this is both the acute side effects that you see from radiation to the brain, as well as the later, more delayed effects. And it's a number of different types of syndromes or presentations that you can see. Typically in the more acute setting, patients that are getting radiation to the brain, you can see an exacerbation of the symptoms related to the tumor. The tumor's inflamed, responding to the radiation. It can cause an increase in edema. And so patients can have symptoms of increased intracranial pressure, seizures, or really just worsening of focal neurologic symptoms that they had related to the tumor previously, prior to starting radiation. That's probably the more acute side effects that you can see. You can also see increased edema in a bit more of a delayed fashion, so not right at the time that the radiation is happening, but in the weeks afterwards, again, as the tumor is responding to the radiation, there's necrosis, tumor cells are dying, it causes increased inflammation and swelling, and so you can even see that worsening of neurologic symptoms in the weeks following radiation. Perhaps the most important category to be aware of, though, are the late delayed complications. When I say late delayed, that means usually a year, 2 years after the radiation to the brain is completed. And that includes both whole brain radiation and more targeted forms, either involved field radiation or gamma knife, which is very targeted to particular lesions. All those categories can lead to these late delayed complications years later. Usually in the 1 to 2 year range, that's where we're looking at an increased risk for something called radiation necrosis. It can often be mistaken for recurrence or relapse of the tumor itself, when in reality, it's just delayed inflammation or radiation injury causing inflammation and edema. Just like the tumor can cause neurologic symptoms, but it's managed with things that are directed towards inflammation and edema. So steroids or Avastin, which we mentioned earlier, is another medication that can be used for that. Other late delayed complications, and this probably more on the order of several years, you can see neurocognitive decline, particularly with whole brain radiation. It essentially can induce a neurocognitive impairment, a dementia-like state years down the line. You can see parenchymal changes. In keeping with that, patients develop generalized atrophy. Some of the late complications of radiation, the things that you see 10, 15, 20 years down the line, are going to be vasculopathy, vessel injuries from the radiation, and that leading to increased risk of stroke or hemorrhage in the area of the brain that previously received radiation. Or there's also the phenomenon of radiation-induced malignancy, secondary tumor formation. We can see this in patients that had a cancer diagnosis as a child. They either received cerebrospinal radiation, radiation from head to toe, or just radiation to the brain. And then later in life, we'll come in with either radiation-induced meningioma is a common one that we'll see, or a glioma can be a radiation-induced tumor as well.
What are some risk factors for radiation damage to the nervous system?
So that's a good question. So there are both factors of the radiation itself and then host-related factors. So I would say for the latter category, patient-specific things, patients of older age, patients with underlying tumor predisposition syndromes or genetic syndromes that predispose one to developing cancer, patients that have underlying impaired brain substrate, either have had history of strokes or have atrophy and dementia already, those are all patients that I would put at an increased risk for developing some of these radiation-related side effects. Another example would be patients that have had a lot of exposure to certain chemotherapy or systemic therapy agents. Methotrexate is probably one in that category. Patients that have had a lot of exposure to systemic methotrexate and then get radiation on top of that are going to be an increased risk for developing radiation necrosis and some of these side effects. And those are probably some of the big ones. In terms of radiation-related factors, so the dose is going to be a major one, both the overall dose and then the dose with each fraction of radiation. Most radiation techniques, with the exception of maybe something like gamma knife radiation, you're not going to get all the radiation to your brain at once. They break it up in something called fractions. And so the dose given during each of those fractions also plays a role. The volume of irradiated tissue plays a role. More likely to develop radiation necrosis when a large volume is being irradiated as opposed to a very small one. And the energy of the radiation can play a role as well. We have techniques where it's the more conventional photon radiation, but now there's proton beam radiation, which is perhaps more effective at sparing critical structures and really targeting the tumor itself. But our patients can have an increased risk of developing radiation necrosis with that particular radiation type.
So that's a good discussion of radiation-induced neurotoxicity in the central nervous system. It's probably also helpful for our listeners to touch on radiation-induced neurotoxicity of the peripheral nervous system.
Probably the one that comes to mind first when you mention that is patients with prostate cancer that get radiation to the pelvic and prostate area and then will develop basically neuropathy of those cauda-equina nerve roots or some of the lumbar plexus nerves. Patients with breast cancer that will get radiation to the breast or to the lymph node areas up in the arm can develop brachioplexopathies down the line.
So if we were to perform electromyography and nerve conduction study on some of these patients, what's the key finding that our listeners should be aware of?
Ah, yes, very testable question right here. So one of the things that you should look out for, it would be myokymia on the EMGs.
And for a more detailed description of what myokymia actually is, I'll refer you back to our neuromuscular episodes where we've discussed the electromyography findings in detail. So as we talked about earlier, immune checkpoint inhibitors or immunotherapy agents are an increasingly common modality for treatment of various malignancies, and they come with their own host of neurologic complications.
So immunotherapies in general, they really take advantage of this idea that our body naturally has some degree of immune response to cancer, right? Especially outside the brain. In the brain, that's a different scenario, a different conversation. But outside the brain, our body does to some degree have an immune response to these foreign cancerous cells. And the idea of immunotherapies, and so the first example would be the immune checkpoint inhibitor therapies, is that they take advantage of and hijack this response that our body has and really build on it to enhance the immune response against the cancer and fight the cancer that way. These are monoclonal antibodies that inhibit the normal immune checkpoints of our body. Immune checkpoints basically keep our immune system regulated. They keep it from having disproportionate responses, developing autoimmune conditions, things like that. Doesn't work perfectly for everyone, and that's how you get autoimmune disease. But for the most part, that's the role of these immune checkpoints, is to help us regulate our immune response to things. These monoclonal antibodies inhibit that response, and basically the immune system goes buck wild in a way that is meant to target the cancer cells itself, but there can be off-target effects, and those cause a spectrum of syndromes in different systems of the body, gastrointestinal, pulmonary, skin, cardiac, what have you. But neurologic is a big category that would be included there. So some of the checkpoint inhibitors to be aware of, ipilimumab is one. That's a monoclonal antibody against CTLA-4, or cytotoxic T lymphocyte-associated protein 4. There are antibodies against programmed cell death 1, PD-1. That would be nivolumab and pembrolizumab, which I'm sure listeners have heard about. And then there are also antibodies against programmed death ligand 1, or PD-L1. That includes atezolizumab. And certain of these have a quote-unquote higher risk for developing neurotoxicities than others. Sometimes the combination, ipi-nivo in combination, has a higher risk of developing them as opposed to just one agent alone. But in general, patients on these medications that come in with new neurologic symptoms, adverse effect neurotoxicity from the drug is something that you need to be aware of. Now, what does that neurologic side effect look like? And really, it can look like a lot of things. Really just think about any part of the nervous system, and then if there was an immune response against it, what the syndrome would look like. So what are we looking for with these neurologic syndromes related to immune checkpoint inhibitors? Well, just like chemotherapy, just like radiation-induced neurotoxicities, we can think about it in both the peripheral and the central nervous system categories. In the peripheral nervous system category, major ones to be aware of are myasthenia gravis and myositis. There can often be overlap between the two. And actually folded into that as well, myocarditis, a non-neurologic immune-related adverse event. We can see an overlap of myasthenia, myositis, and myocarditis that can be quite highly morbid and fatal for patients if not aggressively managed. Other peripheral neurologic syndromes, I should say, peripheral neuropathy is one to look out for, both a smoldering sensory neuropathy or the more acute forms like an AIDP or a Guillain-Barré type of picture. Also been described are things like plexitis, mononeuritis multiplex, cranial mononeuropathies, or even like a dorsal root ganglionopathy. All of these things have been described as immune-related adverse events secondary to immune checkpoint inhibitors. In the central nervous system, so in the brain and the spinal cord, syndromes to be aware of, encephalitis is one, aseptic meningitis another. Press, again, always makes an appearance in these types of things. Demyelinating syndromes, transverse myelitis, and actually, perhaps not so much a central nervous system entity, but just something to be aware of is that you can have almost this unmasking of paraneoplastic syndromes with immune checkpoint inhibitors. If you think about it, paraneoplastic syndromes, right, they're this immune-mediated response to the cancer that our body has, and then we give patients this medication that basically unhinges the immune system to attack the cancer. You're almost augmenting a paraneoplastic syndrome that may be there. And so it's something that's fairly well described that you see patients start immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy, and then something that would be more classically thought of as a paraneoplastic syndrome just becomes augmented out of control. And that needs to be managed aggressively with immune modulating therapy.
So I think one thing that's important for our listeners to keep in mind is that these syndromes are very important to recognize early, because early treatment is critical. They can be fatal if left unrecognized. So definitely something to always keep in mind whenever we see a patient who's receiving immunotherapy.
Absolutely. And I mentioned it before with the myasthenia, myositis, myocarditis overlap, but with encephalitis as well. These things can start, they have some diplopia and maybe a bit of chest pain, and then within a day or so can really ramp up into a severe condition. So having that on your differential when patients come in with these symptoms and have a history of use of these medications is key. And it's important too, because the management then really becomes focused on suppressing or controlling the immune response, because that's really what's driving these side effects, these syndromes. And so, of course, one, holding the immunotherapy, which usually these are given as infusions anyway, so they would have gotten an infusion and then you just hold further ones. But administering steroids and escalating if needed to other immune modulating things like IVIG, rituximab. There's some specific agents now that they have in the cardio-oncology world to address myocarditis related to immune checkpoint inhibitors. These are all tools that we have, but identifying early is the key. And when would you expect to see these symptoms in the course of immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy? Usually it's going to be around cycle 2, cycle 3 of these medications, probably the more common time for them to emerge. Much more uncommon the farther out you get. Been on this medication for months or up to a year. Sometimes patients are maintained on these medications. It's going to be less likely to see an immune checkpoint inhibitor complication arise at that point, although not impossible. So say a patient has a complication like this, right? They're getting ipi/nivo, for example. It's doing a really good job of controlling their cancer, but they come in, they have myasthenia, myositis, and prolonged hospitalization for that. Does that mean we have to stop the immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy? It can be a difficult decision to make, especially when it's working well for a patient controlling their cancer. It's hard to accept that we may need to stop this medication because they had this adverse effect. What goes into that decision to decide whether or not to discontinue it? There's a variety of things, again, patient specific, but one of the things that helps guide it is how we grade the adverse event. And there's a number of governing organizations that have different grading criteria, but in general, you're going to have grade 1 being the most mild symptoms, and then upwards grade 4, grade 5, depending on what grading classification system you're using, being the more severe symptoms. Usually the highest grade, like a grade 5, for example, would be death. And generally speaking, when you're getting up to above a grade 3, that's when you're in a zone where you're not going to be challenging that patient with immunotherapy again. That's a broad statement. It really depends on the individual, what they failed before in terms of treatment, what the options are ahead, risk-benefit calculus to what they're willing to accept in terms of risk in order to try to keep using this treatment against the cancer can be very variable. But generally speaking, the higher severity of the neurologic complication, the less likely that patient's going to be a candidate to resume the medication again.
And once again, I'll refer our listeners back to the recent Neuro-Oncology Continuum, which again is a fantastic resource and has several great tables and diagrams describing and detailing the immune checkpoint inhibitor-related neurotoxicity syndromes. Next, let's move on and talk about a neurologic complication of one specific kind of cancer treatment, in this case, chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy.
Yes, CAR T-cell therapy. So this is especially an inpatient neurology, and if you do inpatient neurology either at or rotate through a major cancer center, CAR T-cell therapy and the neurologic side effects of it is something that you're going to encounter. So what is CAR T-cell therapy? I guess to reflect back, so the immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy that we talked about, right, that was taking advantage of the body's immune response by removing the normal checkpoints used to regulate our immune system by using monoclonal antibodies against those checkpoints. What happens in CAR T-cell therapy, it's actually treatment that's designed to enhance our body's T-cell mediated response against the tumor, or usually particular surface proteins on the tumor, and basically harvests our own T-cells to enhance this response, administers those T-cells back to us, they're engineered against the particular antigen, and then unleashes the immune response that way. And typically this happens in a controlled fashion in the inpatient setting. These patients will have their T-cells harvested at some period before, and then they will do a regimen of lymphodepleting chemotherapy to really get their body prepared for the CAR T-cells, and then they'll be admitted to the hospital, receive the CAR T-cell infusion, and then usually you're in the hospital for a couple of weeks or so to monitor for immune-mediated side effects, or really side effects related to the unleashing of the immune system, I should say. The neurologic side effects of that can be quite severe and also fatal if not recognized early and managed aggressively. Typically, the things that we will look out for in this particular case are going to be patients having increased word-finding difficulty, a bit more confused, developing things like tremors. In its more severe fashion, patients can start to have seizures, become comatose, develop pretty severe cerebral edema. And that transition from subtle symptoms to more severe symptoms can happen quickly. And so while these patients are in the hospital after having received their CAR T-cells, generally they're going to be monitored on a pretty regular basis with neurologic assessments, typically by nursing staff. And as soon as something starts to change, they become a little bit more disoriented or a bit more inattentive, that triggers a whole protocol to begin steroids to help control the immune response that's happening a bit. I will say we don't see the severe cases of it so much anymore, at least in my experience. I think, one, we've been better at identifying it early and starting steroids before things get severe. But two, I think it's probably just a product of having more refined formulations of these medications compared to the very early days when it started being used. But it's still something that we look out for and have to manage aggressively if it occurs.
So is there a name for this syndrome?
Oh, yes. Just like the chimeric antigen T-cell receptor therapy has a nice easy name called CAR T-cell therapy, the formal name for this would be immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity syndrome, but we can also call that ICANS, and that's a bit easier to say.
I think a question several listeners might have is, if anyone has rotated through some kind of hematology service in their intern year, one of the things that's drilled into our heads is, thou shalt not administer a chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy patient to corticosteroids because it will destroy the efficacy of the chimeric antigen receptor T-cells. So is this an exception to that rule?
It is the exception, and I will say the thinking on it has changed a little bit. I can't speak to it with as much expertise and nuance as a transplant hematologist would, but the more classical thinking was that administering steroids would basically just negate the effect of what we were doing with the CAR T-cell therapy. The impression has become a bit less harsh with time and with better understanding. This treatment still works, even if you have to use steroids. And the treatment doesn't do much good if you don't aggressively manage these complications and the patient doesn't survive the treatment. So it's all about balancing, maximizing your therapy or the efficacy of it, but also keeping the patient safe and alive. And so it is an exception in that sense where these patients can and do receive steroids. But often there's a flag on the chart too. It can't be taken lightly and needs to be discussed with the transplant hematologist taking care of them. And so often when we're consulted on these patients, we're communicating directly with that hematologist, the team taking care of the patient, to ensure that what we're seeing is something that is actually worthy and indicates starting steroids.
And another treatment that's gotten a lot of press recently with the COVID pandemic is tocilizumab, but initially that was something that can be used in patients with immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndromes, right, in certain cases?
Yes, so tocilizumab, it's an IL-6, interleukin-6 receptor antibody. You'll often see used in these patients when they start to develop side effects. I'd say not so much for the neurotoxicity, but more for the systemic response to the CAR T-cell therapy. It's called cytokine release syndrome. And there are certain criteria that may be met. Patients are having fevers, hypotensive, new oxygen requirement, that they'll meet criteria to receive tocilizumab to help control that.
What's the typical time course for patients to develop immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome?
So typically, if it happens, it happens within the first 3 to 10 days or so after the CAR T-cell administration. And that's part of the reason why that's included in the time frame that patients stay in the hospital for close monitoring before they're discharged back out into the community, because that is the period of the highest likelihood of it happening. That's not to say the risk is eliminated entirely once you get past the 10-day or 2-week mark. It still exists, and certainly I've seen a number of patients readmitted to the hospital with neurologic symptoms concerning for ICANS, but it becomes less common, I would say, after that initial 2-week interval.
What are some of the risk factors that you think about for neurotoxicity?
Similar to what we've discussed before in terms of the radiation, there's patient-specific factors. So patients of an older age that have perhaps a bit more of a, what we would consider an impaired brain substrate at baseline, either due to dementia or prior strokes or things like that, are going to be at an increased risk for these types of things. Another patient-specific factor would also be the burden of disease of the lymphoma. I mean, generally, similar to a more typical transplant, you try and have minimal disease before doing a treatment like this. But patients with a higher burden of disease or theoretically that have lymphoma in the brain or in the spinal fluid may be at an increased risk for developing this type of neurotoxicity as well.
So what are some of the common tools that are used to monitor patients during this time period?
There will be a standard assessment that's done to monitor patients, and it's more of a screening tool than anything else, just to trigger or raise the flag that something has changed. The ICE score is probably the one that you will see on your inpatient rotations, ICE meaning immune effector cell associated encephalopathy tool. I'm glad they have abbreviations for these things. They are a mouthful. But that tool basically, again, assessing orientation, having them name some objects, follow some commands, some assessment of attention, usually counting backwards, and then there's an assessment of writing that's included in this tool as well. So patients will write generally the same sentence with each assessment, and it's on the same sheet of paper. And in patients where they do develop neurotoxicity, when you look at the sheet of paper, you can actually see a visual representation of their function declining over a period of time. Their writing can get smaller, becomes a bit more difficult to understand, and then they just can stop writing entirely. So that's another way that they keep an eye on them. And usually when these things start to change on this ICE score and they start to develop deficits, that's when it triggers a more formal neurologic reevaluation by a neurologist team and a conversation about starting steroids.
One last related syndrome that I've gotten a lot of requests for us to touch on is immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. For the medical historians out there, this was initially described in the 1980s in leprosy patients undergoing treatment, and later with the HIV/AIDS epidemic in patients undergoing new antiretroviral therapy after having very, very low CD4 counts. So this is initially something that was really recognized in the infectious diseases world, and I think that's probably where most of our patients are still going to live. But it's something that we can also see in the neuro-oncology world. Mm-hmm. So what is immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome? Marion, how do you think about it?
Immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. This is uncontrolled inflammatory response that we can see in patients following a period of transient immune suppression. And so an example of this would be a patient with HIV before they start antiretroviral therapy, when their CD4 count is very low and their viral load is high. They're quite immune deficient during that period of time. And then when you start antiretroviral therapy, their immune system starts to reconstitute. And during this reconstitution phase, you can have this uncontrolled inflammatory response. And that inflammatory response can be a reaction to some sort of foreign antigen, whether it be infection or some other inflammatory cause. But in the neuro-oncology world, one of the things that we can see in this scenario is actually the development of lymphoma. So patients with HIV or patients that are immunocompromised are at an increased risk for lymphoma compared to the general population. And one of the reasons for that, it's a complicated thing, lymphogenesis is, but to boil it down, one of the reasons for that is patients with an immune-compromised state, latent EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, can reactivate, and that is actually something that can induce the development of lymphoma, an oncovirus type of mechanism that occurs. And so patients are immune suppressed, EBV reactivates, and that can cause the development of lymphoma, which would include a primary CNS lymphoma localized only to the brain. Now, that patients with HIV, for example, are at increased risk for EBV-associated primary CNS lymphoma, but that risk is increased even higher within the first 6 months after starting antiretroviral therapy. And the reason being is this phenomenon of immune reconstitution. So the inflammatory response to the EBV is perhaps more excessive during those 6 months as the immune system is reconstituting, then you tend to see the lymphoma at the higher frequency there as opposed to later.
One of the things that makes this challenging is that there's a very heterogeneous presentation, and it really depends on exactly what part of the brain is affected. Mm-hmm. How do people usually think about treatment?
The treatment is going to be twofold. In the case where lymphoma is developing, which again is usually the case that we're going to be involved in, you still need to initiate anti-lymphoma treatment. So just managing supportively the patient during this period of immune reconstitution isn't going to be sufficient. You actually have to use chemotherapy to treat the cancer as well. From the neuro-oncology perspective, when a patient with EBV-associated lymphoma in the context of HIV, be it a more long-term scenario or within the first 6 months of starting antiretroviral therapy, the mainstay from our standpoint is still going to be chemotherapy to address the cancer, in addition to whatever supportive care the patient requires in order to get through this period of immune reconstitution. But chemotherapy is usually an important part of managing this regardless.
All right, excellent. So thank you so much for joining me, Mary, for this very comprehensive summary of all the neurologic complications of systemic cancer treatment. Once again, I'll plug our prior episodes with Dr. Blondin on central nervous system malignancies and a prior episode with Dr. Bauer about paraneoplastic syndromes. And once again, I'll refer our listeners to the Neuro-Oncology Continuum, which has a lot of information in a lot more detail than we're able to cover in a podcast format. We hope this information is going to be helpful to our listeners in both the clinical setting in their everyday practice, as well as on certification examinations, such as the upcoming RITE or board examinations. So thank you again for joining me, Mary.
Thank you, Kevin. It was a pleasure to be here.